from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The game, 49ers versus Vikings. The year, 1988. The place, Candlestick Park.
Young, back to throw. In trouble, he's going to be sacked. No, gets away. He runs, gets away again, goes to the 40, gets away again, to the 35, cuts back at the 30, to the 20, the 50, the 10. He dies, touchdown, 49ers.
The great Lon Simmons describing Steve Young's mad dash for the end zone 25 years ago. As we get ready to turn out the lights at Candlestick in our next hour of Forum, we'll recount moments from that park that will always live on. He gets away again after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. For 53 years, first for the Giants and then for the 49ers, it was home. But 72 hours from now, they'll be getting ready to fire up the Monday night lights at Candlestick Park for the last time. And then it will go dark, and then it will come tumbling down. From now on, what happened at the stick can't stay at the stick, but it will live on in stories, which is what we're going to tell for the next hour. There's Willie Mays and Willie Mack, The Catch, The Quake, and The Vernon Post. There's Joe Cool and Jerry Rice. There's Steve Young, who gets away again, and Stu Miller, who gets blown off the mound. Or did he? It's all part of the Candlestick saga, as are stories like this.
Third down, Alex takes the snap. Alex looking.
Got it.
Post, and it's
got it.
Touchdown! Touchdown, 49!
Ted Robinson and Eric Davis from the 2012 playoff game versus the Saints. We'll talk more about all those stories. We want to hear your stories as well as we spend our next hour saying farewell to Candlestick. You can call in anytime at 866-733-6786. But first, let me welcome our guests for this first part of our program, Ann Killian, sports columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Ann, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you. And Ray Ratto, columnist and commentator for CSN Bay Area. He's been covering sports in the Bay Area since the 1970s. Ray, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So you were both at that last moment. We might as well start with that one, the so-called Vernon Post. Eric Davis did sort of everything wrong for a color commentary, jumped all over Ted Robinson's call, but that's part of what makes it great. You were there, Ray and Ann. What do you remember about that moment? Ray first.
You know, in all honesty, when you pile it up against all the other memories, it's not that amazing, but it's sort of part of the greater piece, which is that it became a place for 49ers memories more than Giants memories. From about 81 on, the 49ers sort of took the place over in a lot of ways. And that was like the last reminder of that, because even in the 90s, when the Giants were good again, it was still thought of more as the place where the 49ers played. And before 81, it was thought of more as the place where the Giants played. So it was sort of an act of closure, because it was probably the last big moment the ballpark ever saw, because I wouldn't anticipate a lot of great import to happen Monday night.
Yeah. And you were at the Vernon Post, as it's now known, the pass from Alex Smith to Vernon. What's your memory from that moment and your sort of takeaways as we approach this last game at Candlestick?
Well, I agree with Ray, which I hate to do, but I agree with Ray that it was really
there's no reason why you should.
It was the last kind of signature moment at Candlestick Park. Obviously, there will not be a playoff game there this year, and it was. I think when we think of great moments at Candlestick, we tend to think of the surprise factor. You know, the top three moments all were take your breath away moments: the catch, the earthquake, and the Willie McCovey line drive in the 1962 World Series Game 7. I mean, those are like big, you know, shocker moments. And I think Alex Smith, more than Vernon Davis catching that ball, it was more that Alex Smith threw it and that the 49ers were going to advance to the NFC title game. They'd been so poor for so long. So I think that's kind of what I take away from that. I do, some people have called that catch three and catch two was Terrell Owens' catch. I mean, there's only, I hate all that. There's one catch and just one alone, and that was in 1981, which Ray Ratto was at. You can see him in the background of the famous picture, but I was not at. I was far, far too young.
Well, let us listen to the catch from that game in January of 1982. The catch.
The football is on the 6-yard line. Talking about six, Tom Landry is 6 yards away from his sixth Super Bowl. And, of course, for the upstart 49ers, they're 6 yards away from Pontiac. Third and three.
We'll see a pick of some kind on the right side, possibly.
Montana.
Ray Ratto, you were there.
I was indeed. In that corner of the end zone, as luck would have it, I got to see really the best thing I saw there was not the catch or even the rollout. It was Everson Walls' reaction, the Dallas cornerback, because when the ball was thrown, I mean, there was no way he was going to make a play on it. So he had to hope that the ball was thrown poorly. And when Clark caught it and came down, I remember very distinctly him emitting a great and loud profanity. I couldn't hear it because it was like standing under a jet, but you could see him mouth it. And it was, since it was only two words, you could figure out which ones they were.
Yeah. Dwight Clark will always be known for that. In some ways, probably more than Montana, because Montana had so many other great achievements in his career. Not that Clark did not, but are there athletes for you and Killian that are also just inextricably tied to Candlestick, like Dwight Clark?
Well, another Clark, Will Clark, I think, is. But, yeah, Dwight is kind of the luckiest guy alive. You know, if he hadn't caught that ball, he might have not had a very long career and might have just been another guy. He always joked that he was, you know, always afraid through those first couple years of his career that he was going to get cut. And you know, he comes down with that catch in bounds, and the world changes, and he happens to have movie star good looks, and he's just kind of a simple Southern guy who's suddenly, you know, just like won the lottery ticket. It's Dwight is one of those great characters in Bay Area sports. It just was, you know, it was the right moment, the right play at the right time. Will Clark, I think, will always be a part of Candlestick memories. You know, his base hit up the middle to put the Giants in the World Series in 1989. Montana, obviously, and Mays, you know, I mean, Montana and Mays, that was one of the great ironies and beauties of Candlestick Park, was here we were in the Bay Area with the absolute worst stadium, so bad that we all took a bizarre pride in just how bad Candlestick Park was, yet we were the beneficiaries of having the two great, arguably the two greatest athletes in their respective sports of all time playing in this dump. And, you know, you can't talk about Willie Mays without thinking what might have been, you know, what might have been, what his numbers might have been if he hadn't played there. And the same with Joe Montana. I mean, the greatest quarterback, arguably, to ever play the game, certainly of his era, you know, to play in this, you know, to make these magical plays in this absolutely historic dump. It's a wonderful contrast. I've always enjoyed it.
Ray Ratto, on that question of sort of the coulda woulda with Willie Mays, how do you place that? I mean, it's impossible, of course, but there's nothing like sports to enjoy fun speculation like. So where would you say what might have happened if Willie Mays had played elsewhere?
Well, I think it wasn't so much the ballpark. He would have hit some more home runs, but Given that I think most people tend to agree that he was the second best player in the history of the game, and it was going to be hard for him to pass Babe Ruth because, unlike Ruth, Mays never pitched, I don't know that it truly depressed his place in history as much as we fantasize that it did. I think we were among the last people in the nation to sort of gravitate to Mays because it was he was a harder sell than guys like McCovey or Cepeda or Marichal because he wasn't homegrown. His career didn't originally blossom in San Francisco, and there's a certain level of conceit that we have about that. And it took really until after he was done playing and then came back to the Giants in the early 90s that people truly appreciated him for who and what he was. But in terms of, you know, his legacy as a player, I don't know that the ballpark was as crushing to him as others do. He would have hit more home runs. He probably would have driven in more runs batted in, but that's sort of like putting another coat of gold paint on a gold bar.
Ray Ratto joining us this morning along with Ann Killian as we remember Candlestick.
Yeah, go ahead, Ann. In my household, we weren't late to the party on the Willie Mays story. I mean, if we had had a shrine, my father would have had a Willie Mays shrine. I mean, I was taught as a young child that he was by far the greatest player to ever play the game, and it was, you know, that I was very, very privileged to have been able to actually see him play in person.
Yeah. Let's stay with baseball for a moment. As Ray and Ann have both noted, in some ways, that the Candlestick became the 49ers' home over time, and that era in which the Giants played there from 1960 into the late 90s, we sometimes don't think as much about, but a little earlier today, I spoke with Giants broadcaster Dwayne Kuiper, who also, of course, played second base for the Giants during his major league career. And so here's a short excerpt from our conversation. We began by talking about what it was like to try to catch a pop fly when you played second at Candlestick.
If I start frantically waving my arms, you know, that means I need some help. and the problem with that is you can yell and you can wave your arms, but one, the guy next to you has got to hear you, and two, he's taking his eye off the ball to see you waving your arms, and now he's got to go back up there and find it again.
So
all in all, it was just a nightmare.
That old phrase, I got it, was never really entirely the truth at
Candlestick. Well, no, we used to joke that the phrase at Candlestick was, you got it. And you can talk to every guy that played in that time frame where Candlestick had baseball, that was the single hardest place to play. It was. And guys just knew it when they came in. I always thought that the Giants had a massive home field advantage because the one star on every team that's going to take a day off is going to take it when they come to San Francisco because that was the toughest place to play. I'm going to take my day off when we go there. Consequently, the Giants are always playing a team where one of their best players was not playing.
Who dealt with it the best of your teammates or in your time broadcasting games? Who sort of figured out Candlestick? Or is that even possible to figure out Candlestick as a baseball player?
Well, pitchers figured it out. I mean, pitchers figured it out. The pitchers had no problems, you know, unless you're Stu Miller, you know, 160 pounds, you get blown off the mound. But if you got, you know, a little weight on you. You know, pitchers love pitching there. My broadcast partner, Mike Kruko, talks about it all the time. He said, what a joy. Yeah, really, what a joy. You're out there once every 5 days. You know, we're out there every day.
And last, favorite memory, something that sticks with you the most about the stick.
Well, it wasn't so much a favorite memory. I wasn't working the game, but the very first World Series game I ever went to was the earthquake game, huh. And I was in the back of the writer's part of the booth with Hank Greenwald. His responsibilities for radio that day were not quite getting started because Ron Fairley was doing the pregame show. So I was just standing in the back, leaning up against the back railing at the stick, and the earthquake hit. And I remember Hank looking at me, and he said, yep, that's exactly what it is. And he scurried off to the radio booth And I really felt like the press box, which, you know, is hanging out over the seats below, it just felt like it went all the way out to the mound like a wave and then came back. And I thought, you know what, they're not going to play this game. So I got out of there immediately. And I got out there so fast, I got to the bridge, and there was a pedestrian turning people around. So you know, that's – and I'll say this about Candlestick. It held up.
Yeah.
I know they had some cracks. I know they had, other things that happened in the earthquake, but it held up. It may have saved a lot of lives. And in a lot of ways, that's probably something that we should never, ever forget.
Comments from Dwayne Kuiper. We spoke earlier today. Ray Ratto, you were there as well. And it is sort of ironic and worth remembering that in some ways that was Candlestick's best day.
Oh, no, it was absolutely Candlestick's best day. I don't know that there's any other ballpark, arena, stadium, gathering place that goes to its construction grave being able to say 65,000 people did not die because of me. And that's not an exaggeration when you consider that a lot of that area was landfill, and landfill was the part of the Bay Area that took the biggest beating in the earthquake. The marina caught on fire, that's largely landfill. The Cypress structure, largely built on landfill. And so when it collapsed, you could say, oh, the ground helped do that. But Candlestick, as horrific looking as it was that tough old barfly that you couldn't get rid of. And that day, it just sort of sent this middle finger up into the sky and said, you're going to have to do better than that to get me.
Ray Ratto from CSN Bay Area joining us along with Ann Killian as we remember the Stick. And we want to spend just a few minutes more on the question of geography, in a way, with Candlestick. And joining us for those observations now is Bill Martin, the chief meteorologist at KTVU Channel 2. Bill, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So just, you can't talk about Candlestick without talking about the weather or natural phenomenon, as Ray was just so wonderfully describing that moment of the earthquake. But answer for us, as we approach this last game, the great question about Candlestick, which is, why was it so windy there?
Well, it makes a little bit of sense when you look at, like, Visitation Valley. That's the valley that runs down to the Stick. It's a low-lying gap at the coastal hills there. It's kind of by the San Bruno Gap. And it is near the San Bruno Gap. And what happens is, in the summer months, when you play baseball, the cold ocean is being sucked into the warmer inland valleys. And in that area is a funnel. You get a Venturi effect through there. And the winds are accelerated to a higher speed than anywhere else in many other places in the Bay Area. And you add to that, we all know that, right? You go out to the Candlestick in the summer, and it's windy and it's cold. But then if you think about this, think about that little mound, that hill that's right in front of the Stick. As you drive in, it's on the west side of the Stick. Well, that creates a sort of a barrier. You think, oh, that'll help block the wind, but it's just big enough that allows that wind that's accelerating down off San Bruno Gap to hit that thing. It splits, goes around it, goes over it, and creates a turbulence that in acceleration, in a turbulence that you don't see many other places. So, that's why they didn't put the airport there, for sure, because that mound is responsible for some of those nasty winds that we talk about at Candlestick. And I think without that there, it would just be this windy place, and it would be consistent, but it wouldn't be this gusty, robust, many different directions, up, down, sideways, Candlestick Park winds that we now know and have come to love.
And just one more question, Bill. Why, when they enclosed Candlestick after the 49ers moved there, you would think that would have made it better, but it didn't. In fact, the winds just kind of swirled around more. Why is that?
That's a great point. Well, these stadiums that they built in the old days, they're circular. They're symmetrical. And the old stadium, if you look back in 1960, the old stadium was circular, but it had some gaps, and it had places for the wind to blow around. It had places for the wind to get broken up and to break the flow. Well, when you encircle something like that, you create this sort of laminar flow around the park. So if a big gust of wind comes in at the top and hits the top rows, it's going to, just like the wave of people making the wave in the crowd, that wind's going to swirl around this perfectly circular, or not perfectly circular, but semi-circular stadium. And so by creating that enclosing it, you actually increased the wind speeds that would flow in the top of that arena and even down at the surface. They've had a lot of, I mean, you talk about the 1961 All-Star game, Stu Miller got blown off the mound. He got called for a balk, the tying run scored. In 1962, they had the Columbus Day, the Giants were in the World Series against the Yankees, and it rained out several days. They got a half foot of rain out there at Candlestick Park. So that place is all about the weather, and that's all that when the announcers on the network would come on from the blimps talking about, oh, beautiful San Francisco, they pan down to Candlestick, and they talk about the weather.
Bill Martin, chief meteorologist at KTVU Channel 2, probably one of the few guys who will miss Candlestick, it sounds like.
My memory is I went there in 1968. I saw the Reds play the Giants, Willie McCovey, Willie Mays. I think Joe Morgan was playing for the Reds, Johnny Bench, and Pete Rose. And it was a doubleheader. I think it was 68 or 69. I remember walking up those stairs. I was a little kid from Paradise, California. I walked up those stairs, and I looked out, and right when you see out that portal and you see all that green, and it was magic. And I'll never forget it. And obviously the players, the doubleheaders that they used to do, but seeing that field for the first time as a 10-year-old boy was amazing.
And probably right about then, the wind was blowing, and you decided you'd become a meteorologist.
We didn't bring, I remember not bringing, it was summertime, and we didn't, coming from Paradise, and we didn't bring coats. And we, 10 little boys at a birthday party froze to death for 18 innings of baseball.
Bill Martin, chief meteorologist, just KTVU. Bill, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dave.
So, Ann Killian, I'm sure you're going to be at the game Monday night. What are you going to be thinking about?
I'll be sentimental. I'll think about my dad, who passed away about 13 years ago and, was the first person I went to Candlestick Park with. And he had a fondness for the place. I have a fondness for the place as weird and decrepit as it is. It's been my office for most of the last 20 years. So there's a part of me, I have a sentimental side, and then I also have a very, practical side, which is, oh my God, am I going to get stuck in the elevator again? Why is it so cold in the press box? How are we going to fight through the crowd to get across the field at the end of the game? I mean, it's all those working concerns that, Candlestick's not great at, but I'll definitely, I'll get a little misty. I definitely have a very sentimental side about Candlestick, having grown up here and grown up going to it, wearing the puffy down jacket in the dead of summer on the upper deck when I was in high school, maybe passing a flask around with my friends. I mean, I'll think about all those moments when the 49ers were so bad you could sneak in without a ticket. There's a big mixture of the personal and the professional.
Favorite single moment, the catch?
For me?
Yeah. I mean, I know you weren't there then, but is that what you think about most? Or you have a single moment?
Yeah, I will probably think about that in terms of, the iconic moment. But personally, I'll probably think about going with my dad when I was in 1992, when the Giants, of course, were going to leave because Candlestick was such a dump and they couldn't get a new ballpark and they were going to move to Florida. I took my father and I took my son, who was just a little tiny guy at the time, just a baby. And so we had a little three-generation moment, and my dad was super sad that the Giants were going to leave because no one could ever figure out how to build a ballpark. And, of course, they didn't leave.
Ann Killian, sports columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Ann, I know you have to leave us. Thanks so much for your contributions to our conversation this morning. Pleasure to have you on.
Nice to be here, and thank you, and happy holidays.
Same to you. We will continue our conversation in a moment, and we'll get to all of your calls, 866-733-6786. With your memories of Candlestick, email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page. Ray Ratto will stay with us. After the break, we'll also hear from the Hall of Famer, Ronnie Lott. He'll join us, and we'll talk more about Candlestick Park. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Candlestick Park will be no more in about 80 hours or so. The last Monday night game will take place on Monday, 49ers' last game at Candlestick. We welcome your calls and remembrances of Candlestick. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. And Ray Ratto's dog is remembering Candlestick at this very moment, I think. Is that what's going on, Ray?
I'm torturing an animal.
All right, good.
Okay. Nothing new here.
just good to clarify that. Anne writes, when I was a kid, my dad would take me out to Candlestick so I could see Willie Mays hit a home run as a birthday present, and he did. Harry says, I had a catering gig for the Steelers the night the lights went out on Monday Night Football. Let's hope that doesn't happen this Monday night. Carl tweets, I agree with your guess. Candlestick was a magnificent dump. My memory was the sea of mud that's called a parking lot. Let's take a call from someone who knows Candlestick very well. Spent a lot of time calling games there. David Glass is calling in, the former Giants broadcaster. David, good morning.
Thank you very much. It's nice to talk to you.
Your memories of a place where you called many a game.
Well, you know, I was interested to hear Bill Martin's comments about Candlestick and the wind factors and what happened with the structure when they enclosed the stadium, because I actually did a pregame show about that issue with Darrell Evans, who is a longtime third baseman and occasional first baseman with the Giants. And Darrell had said that pop-ups there, it was like getting a ball that was shot out of a cannon when it would come down to you. My brothers are both airline pilots. One flew F-4s in the Marine Corps, and I talked to them about the wind velocity, and they said that's exactly what's happening because the curvature of the stadium combined with the topography around the stadium and the enclosure created a wind shear, just like the wind going over an airplane wing, and that it created a high-pressure system. So as the ball went up on a pop-up, it would hit against columns of air and high pressure, and the ball literally would be pushed down on its falling back to earth. And that's why you'd get the crazy things that would happen on pop-ups that Darrell Evans referenced being shot out of a cannon, or that Dwayne Kuiper talked about earlier in your program. So that brings back a remembrance. My favorite remembrance of Candlestick, however, was October 2nd, 1982, when Joe Morgan hit a three-run homer off Terry Forster that knocked the Dodgers out of the pennant after the Dodgers had effectively eliminated the Giants earlier in the weekend from a great pennant chase between the Giants, the Braves, and the Dodgers. And nobody cared at that point that the ballpark was a dump. People enjoyed going there, had a great time. But by 1985, they were giving out something called a quad, a candlestick,
right,
to celebrate fans that stayed through an extra inning night game in a 100-loss season. So Giants fans are the best. They put up with a lot through the years, and now they got the greatest stadium maybe that's ever been built to play in at whatever you call it now, AT&T Park, Back Bell Park. The name doesn't matter. The venue is the best. So they've gone from the outhouse to the penthouse.
David Glass, the former Giants broadcaster, calling in this morning. David, thanks very much. Great memories, and great always to include something that involves a Dodger loss. Here's a quote from Steve Garvey, the former Dodger, who says, I remember walking back to the tunnel after a one-run loss, and something whizzed by me. It was a gin bottle. I picked it up and saw that it was half full. Right there, you knew you were in Candlestick. In New York, they would have kept it full for more impact. At Candlestick, they had to drink half of it to keep warm. Probably one of the better things Steve Garvey ever said. Joining us now, the Hall of Famer Ronnie Lott. Of course, the great former cornerback and safety for the San Francisco 49ers, member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, played for the 49ers throughout the 1980s. Ronnie Lott, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. You're on with Ray Ratto as well from CSN Bay Area. Ronnie, your favorite memory from all those mini games you played in the glory era, the four Super Bowls that took place in the 80s. Does one stand out as you think about now as we approach this last game at Candlestick?
You know, there's some great moments that stand out. Obviously, the catch is a great moment. And arguably the best moment in sport. And when you think about the great moments in that environment in terms of on the field, incredible. But in the locker room, great moments as well. And, you know, the great moment for me was, heck, having a chance to meet Willie Mays.
Huh.
And sitting there as a 22-year-old kid, and Willie Mays just, you know, right there in front of you. And to look at that chance to shake his hand, arguably one of the great moments for me, just because of who he is and what he meant to baseball, what he meant to sport. And so those kind of moments are moments that happen in the stick, and they happen because we were fortunate enough to be in that environment around that area. And I could think of so many other great moments, but that one just, you know, jumps out at me. And and the reason it jumps out at me is it's Willie Mays, man. It's nothing better than meeting the best ever in anything.
So,
and that's what I love about, you know, being at Candlestick and having a moment like that.
It's so interesting that the moment that jumps out for you was a moment of in the locker room, number one, and with the baseball player, as you say, arguably the greatest of all time, Willie Mays. Are there other memories of particular people, Ronnie Lott, that you played with, particular bonds, I guess, that were forged at Candlestick that for you remain as important as all those great victories?
Yeah, there are a lot of them. Because, you know, the pain of losing sometimes makes you stronger. And we had a lot of moments where there was incredible pain over the years of losing games. I remember Eddie DeBarlo literally, you know, kicking the Coke machine, you know, the Coke bending machine and breaking the glass, and because that loss was a loss that for him, you know, was a loss that we shouldn't have lost, and people, you know, you look at that and you say, why did it mean so much? It meant so much because that's how he felt. That, you know, those are real emotions, and we had a lot of guys on our team that were like Eddie DeBarlo that had those kind of feelings and had those type of moments. And, you know, Jerry Rice had those type of moments where, you know, it hurt so bad that he was crying after a game that he dropped some balls, and even though we won, he was still crying because he wasn't at his top. And, you know, just I go back to those moments because it's so easy to talk about the great moments, and yet it's the moments of dealing with some of the pains of trying to be great. I mean, I think of the, you know, I had a terrible game when we played the Cowboys, and had we not won that game, had the catch not happened, that would have been a long day. So I look back at that game and I think of the things that I did wrong that day and how bad I played. And you know, you look at the Minnesota game, losing to that game, losing, everybody thought that we were going straight to a Super Bowl, and you know, we lost in the first game, and losing to the Giants, God, that, you know, I mean, that game to me was one of the most devastating games because we thought winning three in a row, nobody had won three in a row. Nobody had won three in a row, and other than the Green Bay Packers, and that was really centered around the fact that they had won not necessarily three Super Bowls, but they had won one Super Bowl and two championships before that. So you wanted to be in that category, and I remember walking out of there just, I mean, I still haven't even watched the game. You know, that's one game that I have not. I watch a lot of football games and still watch a lot of football, but I haven't even looked at that the tape of that game because it's so painful. But yet it spurred me to go on and move forward, and knowing that those kind of moments in your life are the moments that make you better, that you want to go sharpen your knife. So I think that's some of the things that when I think about those guys, and I think about how hungry they were. And then the other thing I would tell you that real very quickly, and it's just, you know, the Bill Rings, the Tom Homos, some of the guys that are not the guys that everybody talks about, but there's some of the guys that, man, you know, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be where we're at. You know, it took every guy to make it happen. So I'm constantly reminded of it took every guy, and all of those guys played an incredible role and had a big impact. Rick Jervis, I just saw Rick Jervis about a month ago at a DB reunion, and so, yeah, good guys, man. Really unbelievable guys that I had a chance to hang out with at Candlestick.
Ronnie Lott, the great Hall of Famer, a name everyone knows. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for bringing up those names that we don't think about when we think about those the long history of Candlestick Park, the Bill Rings and the Tom Homos. It's worth remembering all those other players and that aren't household names or Hall of Fame names who were part of creating what happened there. Ronnie Lott, thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ray Ratto, who are some of your favorite characters that you covered there? It was interesting to hear Ronnie talk not only about the names we may not have heard of, but as much about loss as about victory.
Well, I mean, when a player talks about Candlestick, it's a lot less about the architecture or the location or the difficulties than it is like the visceral memories of victory and defeat, because that was their office. And they embraced its hateful idiosyncrasies, but it still is those are memories that they feel in their bones when they wake up in the morning. You know, if their hip is acting up or they get a twinge in their knee, I mean, it takes them back to that day. So I'm not surprised that Ronnie's memories are that vivid. But for me, it was different because it doesn't have that. You know, it's more sort of cerebral, because it's people you're talking to, not really, you know, things you've actually achieved yourself on the ground. I remember Jeffrey Leonard.
Yeah.
You know, old penitentiary face, who was a fascinating figure in Giants history that in some ways has been forgotten because he played through some of the bad years. And he was there in 87 and 89. But, you know, as time goes on, and World Series have been won, you know, people sort of skip over him. Rick Rushel, same reason. A lot of the Giants from the 70s and 80s who just were fun to talk to. Willie McGee was a fascinating figure, because if you looked at him, you would make judgments about, well, gee, I don't know if he's worth talking to. But then you talk to him for 2 minutes, and all of a sudden you're talking to him for half an hour, because he understood baseball in ways that so many people didn't. He was an incredibly smart player. You know, the 49ers, just, you know, Bill Walsh, who was a coach, you know, who looked ahead, but in many ways is the sort of coach who you don't see anymore, just because he felt comfortable in different situations and atmospheres, and most coaches don't now. The young Eddie DeBartolo, who, you know, literally, you know, you could light a highway flare off him on some days. There are a lot of people sort of who didn't wear the jersey that sort of leap out at you.
Yeah.
I mean, Crazy Crab, as inane as it was so perfectly Candlestick.
The first mascot, right, before Lucille. Ray, stay with us. I just want to read some other things coming in on other people's memories and what they think about. Scott writes in, around 1961 or two, my best friend's mom took her son and me to our first major league game. She drives up to Candlestick. We do all the parking and walking. And as we get in, my buddy yells, "Come on." We run to the big double doors. We run through them. And I stopped in my tracks. The glowing green grass, the bright right cinder warning track, all the colored seats, the blue sky. My friend's mom asked if I was okay. I said yes, but I'd never seen a baseball game in color before because we didn't have a color TV. Great story. Here's another one from someone who writes in about their favorite moment was a bench-clearing brawl between the Giants and the Dodgers that happened in August of 1965. That was the game when Johnny Roseborough was hit over the head, Ray, with a bat by Juan Marichal. That's before your time covering the Giants, of course, back in the 1960s. But any great Dodger Giants memories for you?
Well, I mean, there was that one because I wasn't there, but I remember it. I remember a doubleheader with the Dodgers when they still had that open space behind the left field fence. And it wasn't meant to be a doubleheader. This is a bit of a lengthy story, but I'll try to truncate it as best I can. It was a Tuesday night doubleheader scheduled because there had been a rare rainout at Candlestick in April, and they were having trouble finding a time to play that game because the open date that the Giants wanted to use was the Monday after the original series, but the Dodgers didn't want to because a lot of them had tickets to go see Bruce Springsteen in L.A. So they schedule it for a Tuesday night, and it is Candlestick cold. And so people are there for the first game, which takes forever, and they are drinking, and they are sour, and they are, you know, Dodger angry, as they could often be. And by the second game, and then the between games, the Giants decided to show a promotional video that went on for like 20 minutes, which meant the delay between games was like twice as long as it normally is. So the people who weren't drunk during the first game got drunk between them. And then the second game went extra innings, went to like 1:30 in the morning. And every time there was a fly ball hit to left field in the second game, the left field bleachers literally would empty and people would run out across this plaza to the outfield fence where they weren't allowed to be, and would sometimes climb the fence, you know, throw things at the Dodger trying to catch the ball. And after the game, Al Rosen, the old general manager, likened it to being at Iwo Jima. And the next day, there were all these bicycle racks in that plaza so that nobody could get to the field ever again. But it was just like this spectacularly surreal sort of bowl of rage that really crystallized for anybody who had never fully understood the Giants, the Dodgers, the ballpark, the weather, the gift of alcohol, just put together in one horrific yet fascinating mix.
Yeah.
That just, you know, and that's the one that's the weather I remember. And the only other one that I remember that just still rings at me, they all talk about the Stu Miller being blown off the mound play. But the best win story ever for me was a night game between the 49ers and the Bears in which the wind was so bad that it blew the Goodyear blimp about 6 miles off course. You could just see it going sideways over the rim of the stadium, and there was no way the pilot could get it back.
I'm going to hold you there just, Ray, for a second, because we want to get to another win story in just a moment. Let me read a couple of other things that have come in that people are writing about. In 1984, my new landlords were huge fans of the 49ers. They invited me to the championship game. They had 49er cushions, fur coats, blankets, even a portable TV. They were in heaven, and there I was trying to act like I knew what was going on, trying to be a grateful guest, but all the time I was just thinking, this seat is worth an entire month's rent. I wish I could go sell it in the parking lot. Let's take a caller, and then we're going to get to one other caller who's we want to have join us. David in Sonoma is first. David, go ahead.
My dad took a buddy of mine and me to a game, and we snuck off, you know, after we got in from our seats, and my friend, we were 17 years old, my friend managed to buy a beer. So we walked down into the end zone, and just as we're getting down there, the Niners scored. And then Ray Wirsing comes up, kicks the ball. I think the wind caught the ball, sent it over the net, and it's coming right for us. My buddy catches the ball, drops the beer, and I knocked the ball out of his hand. And the beer, ball, everything lost. The guy right in front of us got it.
Oh, no. You almost first beer and first football, and you lost them both. But a great story, David. Thank you. Thanks very much. Let's hear next from Wynn in Menlo Park. Wynn, go ahead.
You know, we honor the 72 game of the catch. But
82.
I think there was a
82.
Play in that game that was even more significant at the end. The catch didn't end the game. Dallas still had the ball.
Huh?
About a minute to go, they were marching down the field with Danny White throwing short passes. and they were getting in position for a field goal that was going to win the game. And Lawrence Pillars came in and sacked him, pushed him back past the 50-yard line, too far for a field goal, and basically ensured the win at that point. Nobody ever talks about Lawrence Pillars.
Yeah, great memory. You do sort of think of the catch ending the game. Ray Ratto, you remember that sack?
I do, but it was also sort of another great lesson about what 49er fans valued then and now, which is offense, more specifically passing offense. I don't know that that game would be remembered quite as fondly if Earl Cooper had run the ball into the end zone. It sort of had to be a
right
pass, and it had to be Montana, because that was the idiom in which most 49er fans liked to live then. But Lawrence Pillars did, in fact, win the game. And the fact that he's not remembered for that doesn't say anything about whether he's a memorable player or not. It says everything about what fans hold most dear with the 49ers, which is the ball in the air.
Yeah, but Wynn, thank you. Thanks for reminding us of that. It's good, as what Ronnie Lott did as well, to be reminded of certain players who aren't quite the household names that a Dwight Clark is. So thanks for bringing that to us. Other memories that people are bringing in, the Beatles' last concert. Someone else writes about Dave Dravecki's, the great story of Dave Dravecki. Can you tell that real briefly, Ray?
Well, the Dravecki story is a story in sort of three parts, because the first time was when they discovered that he had cancer, and so it was an incredibly emotional time, both in the clubhouse and in the stands. But he gets through that, and he's making his comeback, and they're playing in Montreal when his arm literally just snaps. You could hear it because there was nobody in the ballpark, and his arm is just sort of flapping sort of uselessly after this throw. You could hear the scream, and everybody knew then, well, that's it. And then the next time he's back at the ballpark, he's in civilian clothes, and the ovation that he got when he was introduced was as loud as I think any giant crowd ever managed. I mean, it was almost like sitting under a jet airliner. I mean, you could get that noise every once in a while in a 49er game, but you rarely got it in a Giant game, but you got it then.
Dave Dravecki, great story. We're going to wrap up, as I think we appropriately should, by talking a little bit about the wind at Candlestick. But the windy day that happened was the day of the 89 quake, which, as a number of people have said, Ray has said, and Dwayne Kuiper as well, that in some ways it was Candlestick's best day because of the fact that it held up and people survived who might not have otherwise. Someone who was there that day is Benjamin Young. He's a former rigger for the theatrical stagehand union, and his job that day was to place colorful windsocks up on the lights. And so he was way up on the catwalk trying to untangle these windsocks that were way up high and wrapped around on those light standards. It happened. And Benji, we asked Benji Young to join us for the last few moments here. What was that? What was that like? What do you remember about that moment when the earthquake happened, Benji?
Well, I was pretty much, it's 220 feet tall, and you're pretty much the focus of the bowl of the stadium because you're way up above. So I was just incredibly impressed by the buzz of the, you know, the Battle of the Bay World Series. And you could hear amazing things up there. It was the last time we were going to climb to try to untangle these decorations that had actually gone up the day before. And overnight, they had gotten tangled in the lights.
And when the earthquake struck, what happened? What did you do?
The whole thing lurched forward. And I was laying on my stomach, leaning out, trying to untangle this thing. And I just saw the whole world move under me. And I was looking right down the beams. You know, it's those tall steel poles, and you could see them bending. It was really frightening to watch these giant steel beams bending as I'm looking down them.
And you crawled over, as I understand the story, and from the catwalk and just held on to the light standard pole. Is that right?
Actually, I didn't go anywhere. It was just white knuckles hang on tightly the whole ride. And actually, I vomited, and the sound of the stadium, of everybody gasping, there's like a collective when the earthquake happens. And believe it or not, it felt like it was a reaction from my vomit. And the whole stadium just made a, you know, that kind of sound.
And to me, the most amazing part of this story is what happened 2 days later, because they asked you if you would go back up there again, and you did.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a job. You have to pretty much do it. I mean, I got called that morning. I thought I got up late. I just went out there on a cup of coffee, and they, you know, before noon, we had climbed three or four of those 200-foot-tall light towers, and I was just exhausted. So as soon as the snack bar opened, like a fool, I ate a bunch of food that I shouldn't have eaten, and that's what happened to me.
Wow, Benji, I'm afraid we have to hold you there because it's we're out of time. But it's a great story and a great way to bid goodbye to Candlestick. Thanks for joining us for that. And Ray Ratto, just give us a last quick benediction on Candlestick Park.
It was an awful looking guy, but he was our guy. And when we spent all the time we spent bad-mouthing it and making fun of it and mocking it, it stood there the one time we really needed him to. And that is the best legacy for that place. More than the games, more than the Beatles, more than everything else, it told the entire earth to go peddle its goods somewhere else for a day.
Ray Ratto from CSN Bay Area. Always a pleasure to have you on our program. Always a pleasure to read and listen to you as well. Ray, thank you.
All righty. Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.